Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of iFreaks. This week, we're talking to Dave Verwer. Dave, do you want to say hello?
Hey, everybody.
Now, we've had you on the show a couple of times. I think we talked about iOS Dev Weekly, and I think we talked about finding packages with Swift PM.
We certainly did, yeah.
But yeah, do you want to just introduce yourself real quick, and then we'll jump in and talk about the topic today?
Yeah, so I guess the way most people might know me is through iOS Dev Weekly, which is a newsletter I send out every Friday. Well, Friday afternoon for me, Friday morning, depending on where you are in America, maybe, which contains a kind of roundup of the week's links and articles and tools and news from the world of iOS development. So it's a kind of a roundup of everything that's happened during the week. And that's been going for about 9 years now. But I run several projects in and around the iOS developer kind of community.
Very cool.
With Headspin, optimize your mobile user experiences 24/7 for any application running on any device and any network anywhere in the world. Their AI-powered analyses track user experience metrics and KPIs over time, from cold and warm starts to errors, crashes, and response times, and audio and video quality to biometric responsiveness. Headspin will automatically surface issues and the root cause information you need to optimize user experience for your product or service, providing actionable insights end-to-end across applications, devices, and networks. With the world's first global device cloud that uses thousands of real SIM-enabled devices on actual carrier and Wi-Fi networks in hundreds of locations around the globe with 100% uptime, keep your mobile user experiences ahead of the pack and achieve mobile success with a unified proactive approach to testing, performance monitoring, and user experience analytics only with Headspin. Learn more at headspin.io.
Yeah, I'm always curious where you find those links, because it sounds like it's a lot of work to pull all that stuff together.
So I find most of those links these days through another project, which I started up a little while ago, which is called the iOS Dev Directory. So I, for years, had been curating my own kind of list of RSS feeds that I liked to monitor. And a couple of years ago, I wanted to kind of expand that list and really try and get everybody who was blogging about iOS development into my feed reader, basically. So I thought, well, rather than do this work myself, I bet the community could do it for me. So I started this project called the iOS Dev Directory. And it's an open list of RSS feeds for everybody who's blogging in the community. And I subscribe to every single one of those feeds. But actually, that OPML file and that feed list is open to the world. So anyone could subscribe to the same list of feeds that I do. And that's where I get most of my links from.
So you just skim them till you see something you like, and then...
Yeah, I will give you a slight warning, which is if you do subscribe to that list of feeds, it's a really big list of feeds. And
yeah, it is.
it can be quite an overwhelming task. But, you know, over the years, I've been doing iOS Dev Weekly now for coming up on 9 years. And you get reasonably good at a glance figuring out whether an article is going to be something you want to investigate a little further, put it on a short list, or definitely going to link to this. So I guess I've become reasonably adept at spotting an article that I'm interested in.
Awesome. What do you subscribe to the blogs with?
It's a reasonably complicated setup I have, as you might imagine. So I use a tool called InnoReader, I-N-O-Reader. And that's an online feed reader. And the reason I picked that one is because it has one very clever feature, which is it can subscribe to not only a feed, but it can subscribe to an OPML file. So whenever I push an update to the iOS dev directory, my feed reader automatically picks up the new feeds. And if anyone ever removes themselves from that directory, it removes that feed from my feed reader. So InnoReader just is constantly in sync for me with the iOS dev directory. And then locally on my own machine, I run the Mac app Reader, which I think is a fantastic feed reader. And I've used that for years and years now. So a combination of Reader, InnoReader, and the iOS dev directory.
Nice. All right. Well, I've sated my curiosity. Now, well, I haven't, but that's not what we brought you on to talk about. So,
sure.
I was like, wow.
We already went down a tangent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we went pretty fast. But yeah, you gave a talk at iOS Conf SG, which is the conference in Singapore. We've had a few other speakers from that conference come and talk to us. And it's kind of funny because I'm used to pulling speakers in from conferences, and it's like, yeah, so 6 months ago, not less than a month ago, but yeah,
just a few weeks back.
But you talked about how to design your app to be discoverable, and so what I'm wondering just right off the bat is what prompted this talk?
So it's a kind of interesting story behind this talk, in that I gave a talk last year called How to Make Your App Feel at Home on iOS 13. And that talk had kind of three sections in it. And that talk generally was a design talk. It wasn't a talk about dark mode. It wasn't a talk about any of the new APIs particularly. It was a design talk, and it was a talk around watching what Apple do and taking inspiration from what Apple do to make your application feel more at home on the platform. And there were three sections to that talk. I talked actually, first of all, about buttons. And quite a significant portion of that talk was actually around just all the different types of buttons in iOS 13, which may sound like a dull topic, but I promise you it was, well, maybe it was. Another large section of that talk was around discoverability, because in iOS 13, Apple did a whole load of work on increasing the discoverability of certain features and apps within the platform. And the more I thought about that talk, the more I thought that actually the discoverability section of that talk is something I don't feel that I had chance to kind of really cover in that talk. So I took that section and I expanded it from being a 10-minute piece in the middle of one talk into being its own whole talk by itself.
Cool. How long did it take you to get the talk together?
Preparing talks is always something that, I mean, it takes a long time, but for a good period of that time, it's nothing more than a notes document or something like that. So I tend to, when I have an idea, and I have several of these documents going on at the same time, when I have an idea for a talk, I'll start a new notes document for it. And over time, I might occasionally just jot down an idea in there, a phrase that I want to say, you know, and that phrase can become, it can end up in the talk, or it can just, it can maybe inspire me to write a section of the talk when it comes time to actually write it. But I'm just constantly filling that document with whatever I can think of on the subject. And it'll come to me in various different places around what, sometimes when I'm working, sometimes when I'm reading articles or looking at apps or something like that, I'll spot something that I'll think, oh, I should mention that in the something talk, right? Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, the kind of the seed of the talk just lives in this notes document. When it actually comes to writing the presentation, obviously it takes a solid piece of work to actually get that put together and put into Keynote. I think I read somewhere once that it takes an hour for every minute of talk or something like that. I think that maybe is a little over the top, but certainly it takes many, many hours to put a good conference talk together.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that a lot of people think, oh, you just make slides and then you present. But what I found is in order to get a smooth delivery and to know how the talk is going to flow, I have to practice it and things like that. And so it just takes a certain amount of time to get it polished enough to really have a good delivered talk.
I think that's a really, in fact, this came up on Twitter just yesterday. How do you practice a talk and how often do you practice a talk? Certainly, I think one of the key things about giving a conference talk is even like make yourself stand up on your own in the office or whatever room you're doing it in. Make yourself stand up, put the clicker in your hand, and go through the talk, speaking it out loud to the cat or the dog or the wall or whoever is there to listen. And do like a proper run through where, and this is another important bit, that you don't get halfway through it and go, oh, I spotted a mistake on that slide. I'm just going to sit down and fix it. Like, you need at least one run through where you don't do that, where you actually perform it to the wall. But before that, I will give it two or three run throughs where I am standing up and speaking, but I will sit down and fix the occasional thing, or where something doesn't quite flow right, I'll reorder the slides and then I'll stand back up again and start over again. But that process of actually rehearsing it and practicing it out loud is really important. At the same time, though, I don't like to over rehearse my talks. So I tend to practice my talk maybe two or three times before I give it. Because I feel if I do it more than that, then you run the risk of it actually coming out as a little bit too stilted, and you know what you're going to say too much, and that can make it not quite sound as natural as it could if you just have a little bit of, well, I'm not quite sure exactly where this is going to go, but I know that on this slide, I'm going to make a couple of points here. On this slide, I'm going to make a couple of different points.
Yeah, I agree. I tend to just practice it until it's comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes that's two or three times. Sometimes if it's stuff that I'm still working through, I'll go through it a few more times. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So as far as discoverability of apps, we're not talking about like app store optimization and stuff, or are we?
We're not. And actually that was an initial problem with the talk. And I'm not sure whether it actually got updated on the iOS Comp Singapore website in the end. But certainly the slides, I did update the slides to rename the talk to be designing your UI for discoverability rather than designing your app for discoverability.
Right.
Because a couple of people actually did contact me before the talk and said, is this a talk about marketing? Because I have talked about marketing before. Like that is something that I do occasionally talk on. But no,
well,
this is
something people struggle with too. So,
and absolutely, yeah, it's a big topic, and I equally could have given a talk on that. But no, this one is about application design. So, not necessarily visual design, but design of your application so that people can figure out what it does and how to use it.
That makes sense. Now I'm curious. I'm kind of tempted to go one way and I'm kind of tempted to go another way. One is still a little bit focused on the App Store, just in the sense that
You know, you have like snapshots and walkthroughs and stuff like that you stick in there. And so people can kind of get an idea of how to use it. But I don't know how many people actually use that feature in the App Store. I usually just find the app, hit get, and then I'm done. The flip side is that we could also just talk about the UI principles as far as just making it natural for people to use the app, which I think is more in line with what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think the preview, are you talking about the preview videos?
Yeah, preview videos. You can also put like just images of the some of the different screens.
Yeah, so I think the preview videos are, they're very interesting actually. I think it's you almost feel like you're missing out if you don't have a preview video. But just like you said, I never watch the preview videos. I do look at the images. I think you should definitely take a lot of care with your App Store images. And you should probably do a video because why not? Like, I don't look at them particularly, but some people might. I kind of agree with you. I'd rather just get the app and download it. Because these days, almost all applications are initially free to download. And I know that was maybe not quite the case when those preview videos first appeared. So maybe they were more useful in those days, but these days I just feel like that get button is right there.
Yep. So then how do you make your app UI more discoverable then?
So I think Apple have contributed to something that you see very prevalently in almost all applications, which is the kind of standard way to teach people about your application is as they launch the application, the first thing you do is show them a kind of walkthrough of here's the first feature, here's the second feature, and you swipe through a few pages of walkthrough. And normally at the end of that walkthrough, you're going to get maybe prompted to do the in-app purchase upgrade to the pro version or whatever it is, the paid version of the application. But effectively, that's become quite a standard mechanism of kind of onboarding people into your application.
And you're Apple talking definitely about do the, this. You're talking about the onboarding sequence where it's like arrow pointing to button. Click here to add your first thingy.
So actually those are more like empty state, screens. So if you have like a table view or something like that, then there might be like an add button up the top right-hand corner. And in that empty state, in that blank empty table view, it became popular for a while to kind of put some animation, so much animation, but put some illustration there saying, point up here to get started or whatever. But I think we've kind of moved on a little bit from there into these kind of onboarding walkthroughs, which are kind of swipe through a few pages of explanation of what the application does, explanation of some of the features, that kind of thing. And Apple do this in their applications. They don't tend to use a swipe thing, but they do show you in almost every first party application a kind of welcome to and then the app name screen. And they all have very similar designs. They're all kind of three or four bullet points with an icon on the left-hand side and a one or two sentence description of a couple of different features in the application. Right. You'll have seen them. They're everywhere.
Early in my career, I figured out which jobs were worth working at and which ones weren't, mostly by trial and error. I created a system that I used to find jobs and later contracts as a freelancer. If you're looking for a job or trying to figure out where you should go next, then check out my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. The book walks you through figuring out what you want, vetting companies that meet your criteria, meeting that company's employees, and getting them to recommend you for a job. Don't settle for whoever has listed their job on the job board. Go out and proactively find the job you'll love. Buy the book at devchat.tv/jobbook. That's devchat.tv/jobbook.
The problem is with those is that when you've just downloaded an application, you're not necessarily in the mood to be educated. And I don't know about you, like you probably had something in mind when you went to get that application. You probably had something you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And the thing that you wanted to do is probably the very basic feature of the application that anybody could figure out how to do. Just get me into the application. I don't want to know about every last feature that exists in this application. So you're often not in the mood to learn about every corner of what's possible. And of course, most applications from somewhere, maybe in the settings screen, allow you to get back to that walkthrough, but who's ever going to do that? And so I think these walkthroughs, they're fine. I don't think we should get rid of them. I think they're okay, but they're also not the answer to discoverability. I think quite often people do a walkthrough and then feel like, well, I'm done. I've taught people how to use my application. And if they didn't read my walkthrough, then I'm washing my hands of that user. You know, I've done my bit. Instead, discoverability can be something that you build throughout your application. And actually, in iOS 13, Apple do this quite a lot. So some of them, I think they've done some really good stuff with, and some they've maybe got a couple of maybe close misses in a few areas. Like one that I think is a bit of a miss is, I don't know whether you remember, when you first launched up iOS 13, do you remember being shown how to use the swipe keyboard?
I don't. I think I probably was shown it, but I don't remember specifically whether or not I went through it or not.
I can guarantee you were shown it. the first time you use the keyboard, like was the first time a keyboard is presented on iOS 13 after you've upgraded to iOS 13, instead of the keyboard, you'll get a little animation. And that animation will show you a picture of a software keyboard, and it will have a little kind of swirl swiping around the keyboard in a figure of eight pattern. And underneath the animation, it says, slide your finger across the letters to compose a word. And then there's a continue button. And that's effectively, that is enough information to figure out how to use that feature. If you read that sentence and see the animation of somebody's finger swiping across the screen, that's enough. The problem, I think, is when you get presented that. So the first time you use the keyboard after upgrading, you're probably right in the middle of doing something. Most likely, you're about to send a text message or an iMessage or something like that. And so you go in, like you have a task in your mind and you're going into the application, in this case, messages, to do something. You're going to text somebody something important. That's the most important thing on your mind when you go into that keyboard. And instead of seeing the keyboard, you see this animation trying to tell you about some new feature. And so I would imagine most people just instantly hit the continue button as if like, what's this? This is just getting in my way. I don't want to learn about stuff now. Just get rid of it, right? So I guarantee that you saw that animation and you saw those words, but I'm not surprised at all that you don't remember it. So it's really important to think about the state of mind that your user is in when you're about to show them some of this discoverability stuff, whether it be a walkthrough or, you know, in a way it's a little frustrating because this idea that Apple had of showing this animation showing you how to use the swipe keyboard at the point where you're just about to see the keyboard seems good in theory. It's just in practice, it's getting in the way again. And again, once it's gone forever.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah.
So actually, I did have, in the presentation, I did have an idea of how potentially that could actually be fixed. So instead of having it as a modal bit of education, so something that blocks off the user from doing what they were intending to do, maybe after the upgrade, the first few times that you use the keyboard, or maybe until the user dismisses it or something like that, maybe above the keyboard, you know, like where that bar is that shows the different words that you can, like predictive words that it's going to insert into the text for you. So either replacing that or above that or somewhere around there, that isn't overlaying the keyboard. You could just have something as simple as, a little tiny little one character height bar saying swipe instead of type, learn more, right? And have the learn more be a button. And it, let's say they see that 10 or 20 times and don't click it. Sure, at that point, hide it and don't show it again. Or put a little X on that as well and let people decide when to hide it. And at the point where you hit learn more, then you can cover over the keyboard. Like at that point, you've got carte blanche to do whatever you want with the screen. Like the user has requested to be educated. They've tapped a button that says learn more. Knock yourselves out at that point.
Right. Yeah, I like that. And you're right. I mean, if I'm getting on to send a text, yeah, I just probably clicked right past it. The other thing that drives me nuts is some of the apps that I've installed in the past, they force you to walk through the walkthrough before you can use it. And if I'm getting it to do a specific task and the walkthrough kind of gets me through that task, I'm okay with it. But then when I install it on my iPad and I have to go through it all over again, I just want to go, no, just go away. Like sync all my data and leave me alone.
Yeah, those ones that don't allow you to skip the walkthrough you have to swipe through every screen of it. It becomes like the swiping Olympics, right? Like how fast can I get to the end of this walkthrough?
Right. So, yeah. So, you know, in the case of the keyboard, yeah, just putting it, you know, above it or something, or, you know, in an app, you know, having something, you know, drop down periodically and remind you, hey, do you want to go through the walkthrough now?
And Apple do this actually in other areas of iOS 13. So for example, in the health application, if you launch up the health application after installing iOS 13, you'll get non-modal prompts to go and discover some of the new features in their application, so in the health application. So one of the new features in iOS 13 was cycle tracking. And if you launch up the health application and haven't explored that feature or haven't set up that feature, it's going to show you as part of that home screen in the health application, a little pop-up that says, it's not a pop-up, it's like it's part of the screen actually. And it says set up cycle tracking. And there's a button on that pop-up that says get started. And again, at that point, the user has chosen to be educated on that feature. There's an X button, and if you dismiss it, then that's it. It's gone forever. You've made a choice that I am not interested in this feature, so please don't tell me about this feature anymore. But I really like that because there's no interruption there, first of all. And if you don't want to learn about whatever the feature is straight away, it's going to be there next time. It's going to be there next time up until the point where you hit that X button. They also use it for, you know, the medical ID feature inside the health application.
I'm sorry, say that again.
The medical ID feature.
Medical
ID. You can set up you can set up an emergency contact.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell it what medication you're on, that kind of stuff. If you haven't yet set one up, there's another panel there that says set up your medical ID, get started. Mm-hmm. And I really like those. I think those, the way that you can kind of think about these is they're almost like they're little adverts within your application for other bits of your application. But adverts, not in a particularly bad way, but that's kind of how you can think about this kind of discoverability feature. It's advertising something that people might want to do in your app, but not getting in their way while you do it.
Yep.
Another place that, again, observing Apple is a great way to learn. Like, it's so valuable to observe what Apple do, even though I've kind of criticized them a couple of times in this talk that we've had tonight. They have an enormous amount of design expertise inside Apple, and they literally wrote the book on this design because it is their book, it's their platform. And they do a huge amount of really, really good work. And one area where, again, they've kind of expanded discoverability in some kind of interesting ways is with Siri. So Siri is a really difficult discoverability problem because you've got this voice assistant that you can say anything to. And even though you can say anything to it, you're going to get along better with Siri if you give it the right phrases. And if you know some of the stuff that it can do, then it's going to be able to help you more often than not. And so discoverability on Siri is really tricky. And Apple have put a huge amount of work into enhancing discoverability, the discoverability of Siri in this release. So for example, if you pull down from the home screen and pull down into Spotlight on the iPhone, and then start typing something like battery, then it will, in Spotlight, it will show you the link to system preferences and position you in the battery settings. But also it might say, at the bottom, it'll have the Siri icon, and it might say, "Hey Siri, turn on low power mode." Oh, sorry, I've just set off everybody. Hey Siri. I'm very sorry, everybody. You have my
apologies. It's Dave's fault, folks.
It's my fault. Yeah, it will say, "Hey somebody, turn on low power mode," and I like that because at the point where you were searching for battery, you weren't even thinking about using the voice assistant, should we call it, the voice assistant to do that. But that discoverability, that kind of ambient discoverability, is just kind of constantly reminding you, hey, there's another way you could do this. Instead of coming into your phone, typing things into the phone, you could just use Siri.
Yep, absolutely. And I love that because, it's kind of a natural prompt, but it's not in the way.
Yeah.
Are you stuck at home climbing the walls when you should be hanging out with the community at the latest conference to get canceled? Are you wondering where to hear your JavaScript heroes like Amy Knight and Douglas Crockford and Chris Heilman? After the cancellations, I decided to put on a JavaScript conference for you online. I invited my favorite folks from around the web and got them to come speak at an online event just for you. Go to jsremoteconf.com and check out our speakers and schedule. The conference is on May 14th and 15th. The call for proposals is open until March 31st. Come join us at an online conference that we guarantee will keep you safe and keep you informed. jsremoteconf.com.
There's another one. Again, going back to Siri, when you load up the messages list for the first time in iOS 13, at the top of your list of conversations, there's a little panel that is there that says talk instead of type. It says text without stopping what you're doing. For example, say, and then it gives you a phrase that you could say to initiate a messages conversation with somebody. That's dismissible. It's scrollable, so you can just scroll it off the screen. It's not going to stop you getting through to that conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I what I really like is these, like I say, you can almost think about them as like adverts for different bits of your application.
Well, and we had a conversation for on iFreaks a few weeks ago with Christina Moulton, and she talked about how to set up, you know, kind of those Siri shortcuts. And what I like is then you've got that reminder, hey, this app
can respond to that particular thing.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's something that iOS is doing, which is, it's actually helping your application's discoverability.
Yeah.
By, if you donate those NS user activity, are they? Is that what they are? I think so. If you donate those NS user activity objects to the operating system, it's going to start suggesting things that your application can do from Spotlight.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, what better place for discoverability than Spotlight? I mean, people use that thing all day, every day.
Yep. It's like the,
I do.
It's like the iTunes podcast feature where essentially it says, you know, if you like this podcast, you'll also like to listen to these podcasts. Does it with the apps exactly. too, right? Except this is, if you're trying to do this, you may also be trying to do this and this.
Yeah.
Very cool. I'm really digging this. I'm going to have to go back and listen again and like write all these down, but.
Well, I mean, so what we've covered tonight is only a quarter of what's actually in the talk as well. So just because I've told you about this doesn't mean you shouldn't go and watch the talk.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I'm wondering too, though, is how do you think about these things, right? I mean, some of it is be on the lookout when you're using your iPhone for things that are like this, right? Oh, somebody did that really well, and I'm going to borrow that approach. But how do you recognize, hey, there's a problem here, a discoverability mm-hmm. problem, and I may need a solution for it?
I think that's actually a really interesting point. And if you do watch the talk, I kind of give a whole load of things that you might want to advertise to your users. But at the same time, what you don't want to do is overwhelm people. You know, if someone goes into your application and they effectively just see 26 adverts for different things that your application can do, that's equally a bad experience.
Right.
And so the context and the when and the where of how to highlight discoverability, how to make the features of your app discoverable is super important. And actually, one thing that's kind of fun that I've not seen anybody actually try this, but it has kind of... Well, actually, I'll tell you the backstory to this, which is I was in New York at the end of last year, and I ended up having breakfast with Felix Krauss, the person who made Fastlane.
Mm-hmm.
So Felix and I were at breakfast, and we were chatting through, and he was telling me about a little thing that he'd been kind of thinking on, of some kind of SDK or framework to figure out like what is a user doing? Is a user currently indoors or outdoors? Are they walking? Are they sitting down? Are they, you know, and all these sensors that we've got in these devices can tell us an enormous amount about what the person is actually doing. And of course, for discoverability or something like that, you wouldn't ever want to ask for permission for those. But there are lots of things that you can figure out, like time of day. Like, for example, is the person connected to a Wi-Fi network or are they on cellular? If the person is connected to the cellular network rather than a Wi-Fi network, they're probably not at home and they're probably not in the office. And so they're probably not in the mood to be forced into learning about something that your application can do. If the time is after midnight and before 5 a.m., they're also probably not going to be in the mood to learn something about your application. Although maybe they are. Maybe they're on shift work or something like that. And maybe you could start gathering analytics about when the kind of normal time that they use your application is and start presenting discoverability prompts during the periods where you think this mm-hmm. user might be more receptive to actually learning something about your application. And you can do a lot of that without being creepy. And it's not particularly creepy just to figure out whether the person is on a Wi-Fi network or a cellular network. It's not creepy to figure out what time it is. The analytics that we put inside applications can be really useful in terms of, or I believe that they could be really useful in terms of picking the right time to maybe present a new bit of information to somebody. And I haven't actually seen anyone do this, but I'm really hopeful that somebody does kind of experiment with this, because I think that that context and timing of this kind of stuff could be a real benefit, both to the user so that they don't get overwhelmed with it, but also it could allow them to discover features of your application that they might not have done before.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that for me, the creepy is when I know they're sending that data, those analytics back somewhere else.
It wouldn't have to do that. No, right. No. This could be like, this could be entirely on device. You could do all of what I just suggested there without transmitting anything anywhere. Yeah. You could also, I really like the idea of kind of figuring out what level of expertise a user has with your application. So if you probably know, or you could at least, you could store and figure out how many times somebody's launched your application, and you can kind of, from what they're doing with your application, we've got to talk very generically here because we're not talking about a specific app here, but generally through the interactions that a user is having with your app, you probably know whether they're a beginner, an intermediate, or an advanced user of your app.
Right.
So use that data to present them different bits of discoverability. Don't take how to do the very basics of your application and present it to someone who's launched your application 1,000 times and has so much data in it that you know that person is absolutely a power user in your application. Maybe for that person, start showing them the new features, the stuff that you introduced in the latest version. Whereas if it is a first launch, those users almost certainly don't want to see the latest little point release feature that you added in, because that will potentially appeal more to a power user application. So all of these things that you could have lots of different types of little kind of discoverability features presented to different classes of users. And of course, all of this depends on the size and the scale of your application. And this won't be relevant for everybody's application, but I do think it's interesting to think about this kind of stuff.
Yep, absolutely. And I love tailoring the experience to them and putting that automation into your app. I think that would be really, really interesting.
I'd love to see people kind of experiment with that.
Yeah.
I'm sure some of the big companies are already doing it. Almost certainly Facebook are doing it.
That wouldn't shock me, but they kind of track your activities across all of Facebook. So in and out of the app, they're probably watching you. Very cool. Well, if people want to dive into this some more, they should go watch the talk. But beyond that, if they want to reach out and say, hey, I had this other idea that's not in the talk, not in the podcast or whatever, how do they find you online and push your buttons?
Sure. The easiest place to find me is daveverwer.com. That's V-E-R-W-E-R if you need to spell it. And from there, you can get a link to my Twitter, which is just, again, Dave Verwer, and all the different things that I do, including iOS Dev Weekly. So yeah, there's every possible way that you'd need to contact me on that site.
Nice. All right. Well, let's go ahead and do some picks. Now, you've been on the show before, so you should be fairly familiar with picks.
I am, yes.
Do you want to shout some stuff out then?
Yeah. So the pick I had is a new application. It's not brand new, but I think it's just maybe 2 or 3 weeks old. So hopefully still new enough that it hasn't been mentioned before. It's called Core Data Lab. It's by a company called Beta Magic. So I like this application because I don't know whether if you ever used Core Data, you end up with this SQLite database in your application. And sure enough, you can open that SQLite database with Base or SQL Pro, or, you know, any of these applications or something like that. But the way that Core Data stores its data, it's got some extra fields, it's got some kind of idiosyncrasies that make a regular SQLite application, maybe not quite perfect for looking at that database. What Core Data Lab does is it's basically a Core Data client. So it's kind of a SQLite browser, but it knows all about Core Data. So it knows about the records, it kind of hides all the idiosyncrasies, and it allows you to kind of interact with your Core Data database. Or it actually defaults to read-only mode, so you can just look at the Core Data database. Because again, I wouldn't really recommend kind of going in there manually and changing things up, but to observe it is really important. And actually, it has a feature which I think is really cool, which is it can effectively track changes to your database and highlight rows in different colors, but depending on whether the data was modified, inserted, deleted. So you can have this kind of live view of your Core Data database right there. And as you use your application, you can see the rows highlight in green and, you know, different colors. I think it's a really cool application.
Very cool. Well, I'm going to jump in here and throw in a couple of recommendations myself. The first one is I've been watching a TV show. I've been watching this for years. The next season came out a few weeks ago, and I just hadn't gotten around to watching it until now because I was watching a different show. It's The Expanse, and it's on Amazon Prime, and I'm really, really enjoying it. So I'm going to pick that. And then, I've been playing a lot with some other technologies, and one that I'm getting into these days is Gridsome. Now, Gridsome is a static site generator. It's built in Vue.js. It's kind of like Gatsby, if you're familiar with it. But anyway, been digging that, so I'm going to shout out about that as well. I'm thinking about moving devchat.tv over to Gridsome. And so anyway, it'll be interesting to see where we wind up with a lot of that stuff. But yeah, those are kind of the things that I'm thinking about these days. So
I built a bit of the Swift PM library, which is one of the projects that I built. That the front end of that was built with Vue. And I really like it. I thought it was a great technology.
Nice. Yeah. I'm really loving Vue. I've been playing with it for a while, and it's really nice framework. So
it's really good. Yeah.
All right. Well, there's not anything else, so we're going to wrap this up. And until next time, max out, everybody.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.